Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and that was Let There Be Drums from Sandy Nelson. And I hope by this time that when people hear that, they turn it way up and just get completely energized, because that's what I do every time I hear it. In fact, they have to send people to come in. You can hear it now. See that? You have to send people in to pull me away and put me down in the seat, strap me into the seat so I can start the show and start talking to people. At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with journalist Dave Lindorf about the constitutional crimes of Barack Obama. That's right, Obama and the gang. We'll be digging into that, what the hell they're doing. Before that, we'll be spending a little bit of time, just a brief visit from Lily Hayden, violinist, vocalist, composer, guitarist, and actress, and she'll be joining us to debut a new song she has out, and she doesn't have it out yet. It's part of an album that will be out, but we're going to be talking about a whole lot of stuff with her, and she will be coming back next week, next Friday, to spend a half an hour with us talking about her work. But opening the show up, I'm really happy to have my next guest, and that's my first guest, actually, Henry Giroux. And I found Henry's article, Violence USA, The Warfare State and the Brutalizing of Everyday Life, on Truthout. And Henry's one of the founding theorists of critical pedagogy in the U.S., and he serves as the Global TV Network Chair in English and Cultural Studies at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario. And the article itself was something that really grabbed my attention, because if you're at all concerned and you look out, if you're at all awake in the deepest sense of being awake, and you look out at the society we live in, you've really got to question and seriously question what's going on in this society. How's it linked to the terrible things that are going on in the world? How is this linked to the fact that the world is a horror? And why is it a horror? And Henry has produced an article that I thought really digs into and poses some very important questions and ideas. So let's jump into it right away. Henry, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me on.
Sure. Well, you in your article, which again, I read it a lot since I first found it, and because it provokes so much in terms of the kind of society we're living in. And you talk about how since 9/11, the boundaries between the realms of war and civil life have collapsed, and that the metaphysics of war and associated violence now creep into everyday life. All right, Henry, what the hell are you talking about there?
Well, one of the things that I'm trying to say in the piece is that war really has become almost the supreme national value. What has happened in the United States is that it not only is a matter of policy affecting what we would call foreign affairs, war actually becomes a mediating force that begins to seep into almost every aspect of daily life. We see it with its logics of cruelty and punishment. We see it seeping into a whole range of institutions. As I say in the piece, increasingly we see schools being modeled after prisons. We see police forces becoming paramilitarized. We see popular culture endlessly celebrating the spectacle of violence. So it's become like an electric current that we simply can't get away from. It becomes a defining organizing principle that becomes one of the few shared mediating forces that now hold almost what I would call everyday life together. So I'm really concerned in this piece about the sort of formative culture that actually produces the celebration and spectacle of violence.
Mm-hmm. And we're going to get into a lot of that as we go along, but I also want to let people know that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And I'm talking today with Henry Giroux. Henry is one of the founding theorists of critical pedagogy in the United States, and he serves as the Global TV Network Chair in English and Cultural Studies at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario. And we're talking about his article, Violence USA, The Warfare State and the Brutalizing of Everyday Life. Now, one of the things that I also wanted to talk about, Henry, is you talk about what you call the permanent warfare state. And I do think, one of the things that's become very increasingly clear to anybody who is honestly watching what's going on in the world and what the U.S. is doing in the world, that there is a permanent state of war on the world, launched by the U.S., fought by the U.S., and it's really trying to establish this like globally unchallenged and unchallengeable empire. And you talk about this being a permanent warfare state and the consequences of that. Can we talk about that? Why do you see it as a permanent warfare state, and what are some of the consequences?
Well, the consequences is that we spread death and destruction all over the globe in the name of advancing democracy. The hypocrisy that sort of formulation sort of in some way takes, the way in which it takes place is almost overwhelming. But I also claim that the United States is a permanent warfare state because of not only the wars that it wages abroad, illegal, immoral, and unjustifiable, but also the war that it wages on women, on workers, and on youth. Even the lexicon that we use in the United States. I mean, Southern senators talking about how we now live in the domestic front has become a battleground in order to justify some of these policies that we're now instituting under Obama that abridge civil liberties. The national the National Defense Authorization Act. Mm-hmm. So I think that the consequences are terrible. I mean, I think that what we have to ask ourselves are a number of questions. One, what are the social costs of having a permanent war state? Who does it benefit, and what are the consequences in terms of the massive destruction that it reproduces? What effects does it have on policy at home? How does it become a tool for governance? How does it function as an ideology? How does it become central to a massive cultural apparatus that now uses violence as the ultimate form of entertainment?
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And I'm talking today with Henry Giroux. Henry is one of the founding theorists of critical pedagogy in the United States, and he serves as the Global TV Network Chair in English and Cultural Studies at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario. And we're talking about his article, Violence, USA, the Warfare State, and the Brutalizing of Everyday Life. Now, Henry, one of the things, just to go back to the beginning of your comment there in terms of unleashing this horror on the world, when you pose that and you talk about basically the mushrooming of war crimes committed by U.S. troops these days, which I don't, you know, it's really sickening. And every time you think it can't get worse, it does, you know, from the urinating on bodies to taking pictures with the body parts, you know, soldiers taking pictures with the body parts to all the kinds of things that are happening. Even the mindless killing and remorseless killing, the fact that you've unleashed a whole army of remorseless killers on the world and they celebrate this thing. But you also, when you're talking there, and I found this very interesting because you make a point that this is not new. This kind of mind-numbing violence isn't new. The U.S. has done this for, you know, almost as long as it's been around. You know, when you look at what it's done to the native people here, when you look at what it did, you know, the dropping of the atom bombs, all the kind of savagery it's unleashed all around the world, you know, that's not new. You know, but actually,
that's true. I say there's a long history of these kinds of savage acts, but I think that what is new is the way in which two things are new. The way in which this violence is now normalized in the culture. It's everywhere. It's aligned with almost every public institution, and it is the product of what some authors have called punishment creep. How modes of punishment, a kind of hyper-punitiveness, now begins to creep into a whole range of institutions, unlike anything we've seen in the past. But I also think that there's something else that you're getting at that really needs to be said. And it operates in the image of reality TV, this world, you know, all against all. It seems to me that we constantly are upping the ante around the spectacle of violence. And I think that we, in some way, have arrived at that point where the only thrill we have left is not just simply engaging in violence, but in some way engaging in the most ruthless and savage forms of violence in order to get the ultimate thrill. I mean, when you look at what happened in Afghanistan with the kill team, I mean, it's not enough to humiliate anymore. I mean, the ultimate act of mediation that violence now performs is actually committing the most unbelievable degradations on human life. And that's scary. I mean, I find that element of pumped-up hyper-punitiveness and violence, it not only deadens the soul and hardens any sense of compassion, but it seems to me it makes murder more than simply entertainment. It makes it a sport.
Yeah, you know, and that's important. And actually, you point out something that really struck me in terms of the kind of the creation of this kind of culture. And it is really troubling because, you know, I was a friend of mine who's a young guy. He's, you know, was just out of college a few years back, and he was looking at YouTube, and he called me over, and he wanted to show me something he thought was just hilarious. And it was this, whatever it was some woman out in the country singing on a band. She was singing some kind of, you know, backward song or something. She was up on a stage, and it was done in a grape squashing. They were like squashing grapes with dancing in a barrel squashing grapes. And suddenly the stage collapsed, and this woman was very seriously hurt. But the person that was showing this to me was just this comedic sense that he found in the suffering of this woman. You know, that I just couldn't, and it's a minor example when you compare it to what you're talking about, what's happening in the world. But the idea that from the most mundane examples of violence and suffering of people to the most horrible, we have in fact, we're living in a culture that exactly as you say, has normalized all this and embraced it. It's really, really disturbing.
You know, I mean, violence and death, well, now it brings cheers to the American public.
Yeah.
Now celebrated as the ultimate form of entertainment. I mean, I love your example because I think it's in the small change of everyday life that you really begin to see how powerful these kinds of things work. You know, as I mentioned in my piece, I mean, even when Susan, my wife, and I saw Hunger Games the other night, and, you know, one could argue that it, in some way it's a critique of some kind of dystopian society that's gone mad. But the other side of this is that, you know, you rarely see any critiques of this film based on the enormous kinds of violence that takes place in it against youth and against children. And I think that when we talk about the violence of everyday life and people gaining satisfaction from it rather than being appalled by it, we have to ask ourselves, what is it about this society that is creating and reinforcing, distributing and circulating this culture of cruelty? Where does it come from? And part of it comes from the fact that all of a sudden we live in a society marked by what some have called a failed sociality. I mean, we have no language for democracy. We have no language for compassion. We view any form of dependency, any form of regard for the other as humiliating. We live in a neoliberal market-driven culture that basically celebrates self-interest. It celebrates narcissism. It celebrates celebrity culture, and it views the news as a joke, a source of entertainment. So it's really not surprising in the lack of any kind of formative culture that would celebrate social relationships that have a sense of compassion and regard for the other that we end up with this. This is a kind of fascist aesthetic. I mean, and I don't say that lightly, because I think that what it does, it allows people to cling to the assumption that certain groups in this society, as the social state is being dismantled by these right-wingers, are utterly disposable and represent excess. And as such, they can be taken care of. They can be eliminated in any way possible, whether we put them in prisons, whether we put them in asylums, or whether we kill them abroad, or whether we just kidnap them and assassinate them. I mean, we're at a very, very dire moment in our history around this question of violence and how it's become the supreme, ultimate form of glue, sort of both entertaining and holding the society together.
Mm-hmm. Couldn't agree more. And let me remind listeners that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Henry Giroux. Henry's one of the founding theorists of critical pedagogy in the United States, and he serves as the Global TV Network Chair in English and Cultural Studies at McMaster University. He is the author of more than 50 books and over 300 academic articles, including his most recent work, The University in Chains, Confronting the Military-Industrial Academic Complex, which actually we're going to get into in a little bit in terms of the way that plays into this whole situation we're talking about. You know, one thing I was thinking, though, about this point about the creation of this kind of culture, you know, you raised a point that I thought was very, very interesting, and especially for someone like me who doesn't follow sports a whole lot. But you raised the point around the New Orleans Saints, and I thought that, you know, because you look at this and really the convergence of insane, mindless, you know, patriarchy, patriotism, and utter war-inspired violence. And what's going on with the New Orleans Saints was just an incredible example. I thought really one that kind of should shock the hell out of people.
No, it's unbelievable. I mean, what I love about that example is that...
You should tell people what the example is, actually.
The example is that the New Orleans Saints, one of the coaches for the Saints, actually was paying players what he called a bounty to actually injure other players who were crucial for them to win the game, players who were basically stars, or players who were playing well, or players who represented a threat to the possibility of the Saints losing the game. Can you imagine? Paid him a bounty of $1,500 to seriously injure another player. And I think that what struck me about that example was not just the utter sheer ruthlessness of it. I mean, my God, I mean, to inflict that kind of injury on another human being in the name of sport, but how that ideology aligns with so many other institutions in the culture. So that the question is not, wow, isn't that crazy? The question is, how is it that something like that can happen, given the fact that it's being normalized everywhere else? I mean, that it aligns with that ideology aligns with so many institutions, whether you're talking about reality TV or whether you're talking about the onslaught of endless shows on crime or whether you're talking about the rise of the punishing state or whether you're talking about schools and now as models for prisons. I mean, that logic is everywhere. So it's not surprising that we see this creeping endlessly into places where we wouldn't expect it.
Yeah. You know, and one of the things, places where we wouldn't expect it. Think about this. We're told day in and day out, and I mean here out in California, you know, there's endless examples of, and it's all over the country. You know, I was just reading an article on guns in the New Yorker, and they were talking about how many guns are owned by, I think there's apparently something like one gun for every person in the U.S., you know, that's actually the number of guns that are
in
circulation. Yeah, okay, 9 out of 10. Something you should be pretty concerned about. But they're also the whole way that gets portrayed, too, is not that the culture that produces this thing, but actually that there's something inherent, and in particular in relation to youth. And one of the areas that you concentrate on in the article, and I think in your work to a certain degree, too, is that what's happening with youth? And, you know, conventional wisdom tells us that the schools are a mess, they're a nest of potential killers, juvenile criminals, psychopaths, and sociopaths that have to be tightly controlled. But you actually get into a pedagogy of brutalizing hardness and dehumanization that's produced and circulated in schools, boot camps, prisons, and other sites. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, you know, thank you, Michael. That's a great question. I mean, especially for the work I'm doing. I mean, one of the things that I have been very concerned about in the last decade is that while the left particularly talks about women, talks about race, talks about gender, talks about class, they really talk about young people. And it seems to me that what we're witnessing in the United States, unlike almost at any other time in its history, is what I call the soft war and the hard war on youth. The soft war is simple. It's the war of utter commercialization, where young people are simply turned into commodities or actually are useful only for buying commodities. But the hard war is something else. The hard war is the punishing war. The hard war means that an increasing number of young people, particularly poor minorities of race and class, are being subjected increasingly to the what I call the tentacles of the criminal justice system. And you see this in many, many sites, from malls to schools, but particularly in schools. I mean, what we have now is we have zero tolerance policies that are just basically nothing more than vehicles for what we call the school-to-prison pipeline. Young black and brown and white poor kids are being thrown out of schools. They're being basically put in the arms of the criminal justice system for infractions that are mind-blowing. I mean, I read a story yesterday about a six-year-old girl, 6 years old, who was handcuffed because she threw a temper tantrum in her kindergarten class. The school called in the police to deal with her. Can you imagine? I mean, young people now are being criminalized, their behavior is being criminalized because they violate dress codes. I mean, the school has basically become an adjunct of the criminal justice system. And I think that we have to ask ourselves, you know, what is it about young people that has allowed this country to see them as nothing more than a public pathology? I mean, why is it that all of a sudden those institutions that should nourish and cherish and invest in children now basically punish them? We no longer have a war on poverty. We have a war on the poor. You know, we no longer have an educational system that educates. It now criminalizes. And to get back to your comment about gun culture and young people, I don't know if you know this, but you know that every year 20,000 children under the age of 20 are killed by firearms in the United States. I mean, that figure alone should raise questions about the predominance of violence and this insidious National Rifle Association and its gun culture in the United States. But we barely get a bleep on the radar over this issue.
Yeah, no kidding, man. Let me remind listeners that we're talking with Henry Giroux, and he's the author of the article Violence USA, The Warfare State and the Brutalizing of Everyday Life, which you can find on Truthout. And he's holds the Global TV Network Chair in English and Cultural Studies at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario. Now, Henry, one of the things that, you know, as you're speaking, I kept thinking about, you know, my experience. I remember the first time I went into a high school here in Los Angeles, and it was down in Watts, and I walked in, and a friend of mine was teaching there, and she was under fire constantly because she refused to let the school security randomly search her students' bags. come into the classroom and randomly search her students' bags for contraband. And, you know, when I walked around the school, I noticed that there was a video camera. There was no spot in the school that you were not under surveillance by video cameras. And, you know, and it became, you know, basically it became, and here's what the authorities used to do, the principal and whatnot. They used to roll dice in the morning or roll a die. And whatever, if it came up 1 to 6, whatever number it came up, they would go to every room that had that number in it. Like if it was 103 and the number was 3, they'd go to 203 or 302 or whatever. They'd just go there and do these random searches. And then they would, you know, basically arrest people, arrest these kids, seize the contraband, kick them out of school, all this other stuff. So this point about being in a cell block was really, really driven home to people. And you make the point that there's this sort of combination of the militarization of the schools and the privatization of the schools informs each other and has real concrete effects. I mean, in terms of society, you talk about stunting the ability to have critical thinking. And then also this point about you creating a situation where, as you were just saying, the people, especially oppressed nationalities and poor, think that they're better off in jail than they are in school.
I mean, what's interesting about that link between militarization and privatization is, remember, you know, there was a time, you know, I think I'm older than you, Michael, but in my generation, when schools were seen as a public good, they weren't just seen as a matter of private interest and a private good. And I think we've completely flipped that script. And in flipping that script, what has often happened is that the governing principle that now organizes schools is basically about de-skilling teachers. It's about making students stupid by educating them simply to take tests. It's about punishing those students that are seen as disposable. It's about basically defining schools as sites of containment. It's about seeing them as ultimately sites of profit. And it's about completely eliminating any association between the purpose of schooling and the imperatives of a democracy. The language of democracy has been completely ripped from the discourse of school reform. We no longer use that language. The language now is about efficiency, training workers, punishing students, and so forth and so on. And so I think that what we have here, and I think that what's interesting about this discussion today is that, you know, we live in a country in which you have the emergence of what I call the punishing state, because the social state is being dismantled. And the only thing left for the state to do is to either work in cahoots with finance capital in order for it to do everything that it can to make as much money as possible, and to contain those populations, those elements, and those individuals who basically oppose a threat to its ideology, its logic, its basic logics, and its organizing principles. So, I mean, the state has so little role left in promoting the public good that the only thing that we now see is a massive emergence of police power and the militarization of everyday life in society. And we see it, for instance, in the way in which the police are now coming down on the peaceful Occupy movements. I mean, here are young people. What are they against? They're against inequality and greed. They protest and they get maced. I mean, what's the message here about what democracy means in this country in light of those kinds of violent actions?
Yeah, exactly. In fact, that was a point I was going to get into with you, was the militarization of the police. And I think you're absolutely right. I mean, you look at that and it really is, you know, even the way the police conduct themselves, just, you know, as you said, coming up against Occupy, I mean, they become these things that you once at one point, you know, and they've always played a certain role in relation to the state. But now this conscious, you know, cloaking them as sort of the Darth Vaders, you know, and really inspiring, trying to inspire fear and terror in people on the basis of this militarization, which is very real when you look at the surveillance, the firepower they have.
The line between the military, the actual military, the armed forces, and, of course, the police is collapsing, as we all know, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, not only do they now dress up and use technologies and weapons that are completely out of line for being used domestically, I mean, if not abroad, to say the least, but they also become a model for a new kind of vigilantism in the United States. I mean, in the sense that that kind of police presence, that emphasis on force, really becomes in some way a model for allowing other groups on the right, particularly, to act in a similar fashion. You know, I mean, think about Trayvon Martin. I mean, this kid who, this young, beautiful black boy, who all of a sudden becomes a criminal because he's cutting through what, a gated community, a community based exclusively on the notions of exclusion and personal security, and we allow civilians who mimic the police to shoot and kill people like this? We actually make it legal by virtue of the laws that are being imposed? I mean, this is not good, and I think it's an index of the growing authoritarianism that we see in the United States.
And it's also, and I know you have to run real quick, but let's try and get one more question in. You can squeeze your answer tight. I'll squeeze my question quick. You talk about it in Standing Up Against All This. You talk about how there should be cultural apparatuses that could be key in creating and shaping an informed and engaged people, but they've unfortunately become little more than market-driven and militarized knowledge factories. But you also cite Stanley Aronowitz saying something that I thought was very important, and that is that the system survives on the eclipse of the radical imagination, the absence of a viable political opposition with roots in the general population, and the conformity of its intellectuals. And in the face of that, you pose that we need something that goes beyond even the idea of having a grammar of political disobedience. Can we talk about that a little?
Well, yeah, I think there are a couple of things quickly. I mean, I think we really need to recognize that education is a central political force. I mean, you have to change consciousness in order to change behavior. I mean, I believe that reason in that sense counts. And the left has, and I think progressives in general, have ignored the notion that pedagogy should be central to any viable notion of politics. They just ignored it. And I think that, secondly, we need to work and create the public spheres, alternative or otherwise, where we can basically challenge much of the militarization, much of the neoliberalism, the market-driven culture, this global insanity that we now see surrounding us. But we have to do it in ways that connect to everyday lives. Thirdly, we have to have social movements. I mean, we cannot rely on a two-party movement that basically is in bed with each other. We need social movements, and we need to refigure the terrain of politics, and we need to, in some way, find a language coupled with the incentive to create those organizations that can change this political landscape. Capitalism and democracy are not the same thing. They are not the same thing. And I think that what we need to do is to look at these countries abroad who are now fighting for the promise of democracy, not its existing reality, and ask ourselves, what do we need to do individually and collectively in every institution that we find ourselves to sort of change that narrative?
All right, Henry, thank you very much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you, Michael. Thank you for inviting me.
Sure, and let's stay in touch, and we'll have you back on again, okay?
Okay,
all right, take care now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've been talking with Henry Giroux, and we've been talking about his article, Violence USA, The Warfare State and the Brutalizing of Everyday Life. Now, there's somebody else. We're going to move into another segment, the middle segment of the show, and I have to tell you, we're not going to have what we normally do as a musical break right at the moment, because I'm really, really, I want to get right into the into the conversation here, and because I think, okay, I'm really taken by the work of my next guest. Her name is Lily Hayden. She's a violinist, vocalist, composer, guitarist, and actress, and boy, I would just run out of breath if I kept on reading. And she's here to talk with us about, she's going to let us listen to one of a new song of hers that will be on a CD that she's coming out sometime in the near future, not immediate future, but sometime in the near future. And her name is Lily Hayden. Lily, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I was really digging your conversation with that. I'm blanking on his name, but he was brilliant, and so are you. Thank you so much.
Yeah, sure. Well, to go from him and now to you, this is going to be an up day, okay? This is going to be cool. I got to tell you, Lily, somebody can tell me everything they want about what you've done and all this other stuff. There are two things that will forever stick in my mind. You didn't have to do anything else. One, when I saw you at Sundance and you were playing with Donovan, and I saw Donovan step back and just stare. And the way, at a certain point, I don't even know if you realize this, at a certain point, you just took over the whole song and your back was parallel to the floor, and it was like, and you and the violin were one. And it was just, the audience was just sitting there and I was sitting there with my mouth open. I just couldn't believe it. It's like everything you sent out from the violin, it's like, that comes out and just wraps around your spinal cord and takes you up. And the other is,
thanks so much.
Sure. And the other is, anybody who has George Clinton say that Lily Hayden, she's the Jimi Hendrix of the violin. It's like, that's it. That's all that I need, okay?
that's very cool. Yeah. I've been really lucky to collaborate with amazing people.
And let me just tell people, too, that we are going to have you in for a half an hour next week. So everybody everybody who piles up all these questions, they can just like sit and wait, because we're going to get down on it next week. I really want to dig into this, but I want people to hear a sample of your music. So we're going to play the piece that you sent me yesterday, the one piece that I really, I just fell in love with this piece, and it's How I Got My Brains Back. Okay.
Oh, okay. Well, thanks.
Yeah, I really like this.
So can I set it up?
Yeah, you can. Yes, definitely. Go ahead.
Okay. So, you know, this ties in. I mean, everything is related, as we know. So, a couple of years ago, I got chemical poisoning from a pesticide that was in my house. That is actually in 30 to 60 million homes in America. The parent company was Chevron, not surprisingly. It's outlawed now, but it's still shipped overseas. It's called Chlordane. And any house built between 1948 and 88 has it in it. And it, the foundation was disturbed during some remediation, and this pesticide contaminated everything I owned. And I, not only did I get very sick, I had to get rid of everything I owned because nothing was salvageable. I was able to save the house by cleaning it with, you know, with hazmat suits and so forth. But I got brain damage. I actually got brain damage, if you can imagine. And I was stupid for about a year. And I tried every therapy that there was around available. And then I started practicing my violin again because I was so busy trying to get better that I wasn't really practicing. And I got a gig where I had to start practicing every day. And I started sight reading Bach and Mendelssohn. And before I knew it, the healing power of music, which is actually now a viable field in neurology, took over, and I experienced a miracle, and I got my brains back. So this song starts with the melody from the Mendelssohn Violin Concerto and then turns into something that I wrote with a friend, and that's going to be on my new record, and it's called How I Got My Brains Back.
All right, and I'll just add one thing. To me, it was kind of like Mendelssohn dipped into a big bowl of chicken grease, okay? I love that. So here it is. Thank you. All right, just amazing. Lily, okay. I'm on the floor. On the floor. Wow, just incredible. Just amazing. It's wow.
Well, thank you so much. I had a lot of fun making that, and the best part is that I got my brains back.
I was just going to say, you certainly did.
Well, you know, at least I try. One thing I will just say, the chemical is called chlordane, mm-hmm. and people should Google it. It's based on the chlorine molecule, so it's chlordane, and there's no legal recourse for it, but you can do what I did to my house, which was encapsulate it. But if you've ever heard of house sickness, that's a lot of it is based on this pesticide, and it's no less relevant today because A, it's still in all these homes, it has no half-life, and B, as we know, Monsanto just keeps gaining ground, and I just read another article yesterday about endocrine blockers that are in so many things that we're actually dealing, you know, that are in the environment that scientists have been begging the FDA to regulate and are still not regulated.
All right, Lily, we're going to have to run now, but I want to let people know that people should tune in next week to see you or to hear you on the show. I think that'll be a blast. I'm going to have a lot of fun with that. Hopefully you will, too.
Music heals. Thank you so much, Michael.
Sure, Lily. Talk to you again soon.
All right, wonderful. Bye-bye.
Take care now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And we've just been talking with Lily Hayden. And I'll remind you once again, Lily is going to join us next week for a discussion, a more in-depth discussion about her music and all things Lily. All right, we're going to take a quick break and be right back to talk with Dave Lindorf about the Obama gang and the constitutional crimes of Barack Obama. So stay tuned. Welcome back, the Slackers with the International War Criminal. You can't get more appropriate for our next conversation. I'm really pleased to welcome back to the show Dave Lindorf. Dave, you know, it's interesting. Dave is one of the founders of This Can't Be Happening, and it's a site that you should go to regularly. It should be happening. And he's a contributor to the upcoming book, Hopeless, Barack Obama and the Politics of Illusion. And he's been relentless in his pursuit of truth in relation to what's going on in the world today. Dave, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Sure. So did you like that song introducing the segment, man?
Absolutely.
Yeah, so damn appropriate. Well, let's talk.
There's some great music being written these days.
Yeah. Let's talk about this. You talk about the current president. Obama is, in truth, a war criminal, easily the equal of his predecessor, George Bush, and perhaps even of Bush's regent, Dick Cheney. And that's a pretty heavy statement to be saying today in this atmosphere, especially as we're leading up to, and I think it's interesting because we're leading up to this whole scene where, you know, once again, people are going for the okey-doke and the cry of, well, at least he's better than Hitler.
Yeah, well, that's probably true. Although I did make a comparison of Bush to Hitler that became fairly controversial early, you know, back in 2003. But let me just back up a second and just tell your listeners that I know whereof I speak because I did write a book called The Case for Impeachment about the Bush administration back in 2006, in which I laid out in detail all the crimes of both the legal crimes, international crimes, and impeachable crimes of President Bush and Vice President Cheney and some of the other members of the Bush administration, you know, Condi Rice and Donald Rumsfeld, et cetera, the whole rogues gallery. So I know what these crimes are, and what has absolutely stunned me, because I will admit that I had right at the as we approached election day, in 2008, I actually wrote a piece in Counterpunch saying that I was voting for Obama because I felt that if at least if you know, like Roosevelt, he seemed fairly conservative, but if the supporters who were backing him, like myself and others, really held his feet to the fire after he was elected, there was a chance we could have some real progressive change. That did not happen, though, of course. You know, after he was elected, people just accepted all the conservative stuff he did without rallying against him. There was sort of, well, we have to back him, he's our guy, kind of thing on the part of liberals, which was a disaster. And so, you know, since then, I've been maybe not surprised, but still, I guess, yes, surprised by the extent to which he has committed the same crimes as his predecessor, and even has gone beyond him to commit some shocking crimes against the Constitution and war crimes that are maybe worse, in some cases I would say definitely worse than those of Bush.
Well, let's give people a sense of the most heinous things that you found that he's done. And we have some time to wander around in this, so you can be as thorough as you want. What are some of the most heinous things that he's done?
Well, let's start out with his first crime right away, saying that he was going to look forward, not backward, and therefore he was not going to have his Justice Department prosecute the known crimes of his predecessor, which was a war crime in itself. Because when under the UN Charter, which the U.S. is a signatory to, it's a treaty that was approved by the Senate and signed into law and becomes part of U.S. law under our Constitution, the invasion of Iraq was a war crime. You can't invade a country that is not an imminent threat to yourself, and that is the number one war crime in the world. It's called a crime against peace. It's a capital punishment crime with no statute of limitations, and a government is bound and its leaders are bound by law to prosecute those who do such crimes, as they are bound to prosecute soldiers who torture. So when the president said he would not prosecute those guys, he was committing a war crime right out of the box. And the worst war crime. His other worst war crime is the overt threat of an attack of an illegal war against Iran, which is underway now, and it's not just words. It's, you know, aircraft battle groups armed with, you know, hundreds of Tomahawk missiles, submarines with Tomahawk missiles, stealth fighter wings that have been shipped over to Dubai aimed at Iraq. These are overt threats of war, and the threat of war is also the number one war crime under the UN Charter. So this president is one step away from the worst, which would be launching that war, and he's already doing a vicious war crime in threatening war.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And we're talking today with Dave Lindorf. Dave's a journalist and a founder of the This Can't Be Happening website and a contributor to Hopeless, Barack Obama and the Politics of Illusion. Now, Dave, you know, when you think about it, too, you think about all these things, all the wars that are going on now, and then this threat of war against Iran. And then there's this point where one of the things that's really, really just, you know, I think should have shocked a lot of people, but has certainly repulsed me in terms of understanding what's going on here. You know, the use of drone warfare and this very, you know, impersonal from the U.S. part, but very personal from the people who are getting hit, and how that ties in with some of these things that actually are war crimes. You know, this thing of, you know, the use of this.
Well, that is a war crime too, because it's the government has admitted that it's launching these things against countries that we are not at war with, which means we are at war with them because these are acts of war.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, they say, well, the CIA is doing it. We're not really, you know, we're not doing it. The CIA is doing it. Somehow if the CIA does it, It's considered not an act of the government. But, right. You know, the rest of the world doesn't see it that way. There's no asterisk in the UN Charter that says you can't attack another country unless it's done with deniability by your intelligence agency.
Exactly.
We make those things. They operate them. There are guys, and it's being done on the orders of the president, who's the commander-in-chief. So these are acts of war against countries like Pakistan that we're not at war with, but we are at war with them.
And then the stuff that comes out, which I think is just incredible. I mean, and this is linked. We'll get into the torture in a minute, but this point that comes up all the time, it doesn't come up nearly enough, but it actually, you get hit in the head with it every now and then, which is the idea that anyone walking down the street can be declared a terrorist, swept up and put away, or that's if you're lucky. Otherwise, you become like the man in Yemen, killed by a drone, and it's on a presidential order, not any recourse to any arrest, trial, accusation, anything. It's just you're taken out because the president has declared you an enemy of the state. This is
in the Constitution. You know, we're supposed to have the right to a trial, and that's not just Americans. It's anyone in America, anyone on American soil. That means, you know, these people the right likes to call illegals have as many rights as we do with regard to arrest, supposedly. And those rights have just vanished. But when it comes to killing Americans, my God, not only can you be arrested and taken away in the dead of night, it can be done with no charges filed, nobody notified that you've been taken, nobody has to know you've been gone. We used to call that disappearing, which we attributed to these Latin American juntas. So now that's under executive order allowed here, but it can be done by the military. Under this new regime, we can be snatched by soldiers and taken away in the dead of night to God knows where, and we can be killed, we can be held indefinitely, we can be taken out of the country and put into some black site, tortured, only they won't call it torture. And killed.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And I'm talking today with Dave Lindorf. Dave's a journalist and founder of This Can't Be Happening. He's a contributor to the upcoming book, Hopeless, Barack Obama and the Politics of Illusion. Now, Dave, one of the things that you hit right on something that I think is just so revealing in terms of these war crimes, the fact that torture has not even, it's become a matter of, you know, whether it's right or wrong has become a matter of policy, and whether policy is right or wrong, and not actually there's an absolute, you know, command that, you know, there's a moral principle. There's a principle here that torture is wrong, that Obama has basically reduced to a matter of policy. And this is a very heavy thing. And to me, that the idea of the renditioning, the creation of what, who knows what the hell is going on at the Bagram Air Base and the prison they have there, that dark site that nobody knows anything about. It was bad enough knowing what was going on there. Now this whole question of what's happening and people being renditioned to this, and the arm in arm with torturers around the world. This itself is also a war crime.
That's absolutely right. The law is very clear. That the U.S. is committed to, which is the Geneva Conventions, that torture, which is very broadly defined, is a war crime. And torture is, if you read the statute, it refers to not just physical torture, but mental torture, things like sleep deprivation, things like, holding an empty gun to someone's head and clicking the trigger, psychological torture, things like that are torture. And there's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. Those are torture. And yet all the discussion in the U.S. is simply around, does torture work?
Mm-hmm.
And that's not supposed to be the discussion. The discussion is, did you torture or not? It's illegal if you did, and it's a capital punishment war crime. When Bush was authorizing it, his White House attorney Alberto Gonzalez, sent a letter which I published in full in my book, in which he warns President Bush that some future administration could decide to prosecute him, and he, in italics, he puts that the the penalty for that crime, which has no statute, is capital punishment. So he's warning the president, this could happen to you, and should have, if this president who's now in office had done his duty and initiated a prosecution when he took office. Mm-hmm. And the same should be done to Obama, because he's authorizing this kind of treatment of people captured by Americans. But he's, as you say, he's expanded it to, you know, under Bush, Jose Padilla was subjected to torture, an American citizen. He went ahead and did it. He just didn't sign an executive order saying he was going to do it. Now, this president just says, I have a right to do this, you know. So, I mean, they drove Jose Padilla crazy. They deprived him of all sensory perception. There was a picture I saw of him being moved out of his windowless cell for some kind of dental work that was going to be done, which, if he's lucky, it was real dental work and not just yanking his teeth out without, you know, sedative. When they were, the picture of him being removed from his cell showed him chained with mittens on his hands so that he couldn't feel anything with his hands, and with blinders on his eyes and, you know, heavy duty ear coverings on his ears so that he heard no sounds, saw no light. And this is sick.
Yeah.
It was, he was being deprived of all sense that there was anything outside his room for over a year.
You know, and it's worse than sick because, you know, actually, I don't know if you saw this, but the Ninth Circuit Court, the federal court, just recently had made a decision in Padilla's case, and they said that he's not allowed to sue John Yoo because actually at the time it was not all that clear what torture was. And apparently Obama's continuing. It's not all that clear that this stuff actually is torture as opposed to like little bothersome pinpricks on your feet or something, you know?
Yeah, there's no question. That's complete and utter bull coming from a constitutional scholar, supposedly. It's very clear, and it's defined in – I wish I had my book with me because I could quote to you. I do. Hold on one second.
Okay.
While we're talking, I'm going to find you the actual statutory
quote. But we only have about a half a minute, man.
No, is that right?
Yeah.
Is that all when we're done?
Yeah, that's when we're done, brother.
Oh, I thought we had longer time. No. Well, you know, I would commend people to get my book, this the Case for Impeachment, which lays all this out really well. Mm-hmm. But it's there's no ambiguity about what torture is. When people say, oh, you know, we don't know whether that's really torture, that's not, you know, as so bad, it's completely baloney. The statute makes it clear that even the least kind of mental torture is torture.
And that is a war crime. And, Dave, we have to run right now. So thank you very much for joining us again.
Okay, thank you for having me on.
Okay, talk to you again soon. Bye. Take care now. All right, that just about brings our show to a close this week. And before we leave, though, there's something I'd like to read to you. You know, it's a very strong undercurrent of today's show and something that's concerned a lot of all of our guests, actually, the question of democracy. And I think this is an important subject to dig into because, after all, there really is a question that democracy, what are we talking about when we talk about democracy in relation to the system we live under? And while I'm tempted to say democracy, can't we do better than that? I actually think it'd be more important and more to the point to read a statement from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, on this question of democracy. So here it is. In a world marked by profound class divisions and social inequality, to talk about democracy without talking about the class nature of that democracy and which class it serves is meaningless and worse. So long as society is divided into classes, there can be no democracy for all. One class or another will rule, and it will uphold and promote the kind of democracy which serves its interests and goals. The question is, which class will rule, and whether its rule and its system of democracy will serve the continuation or the eventual abolition of class divisions and the corresponding relations of exploitation, oppression, and inequality. And that's from Bob Avakian. It's three sentences on democracy. And you know, I'd really like to encourage people, think about those sentences. Think about what's posed in there and write to me with your thoughts. Let me know what you think about this because it's time we really started debating out this issue of democracy, what it means, what kind of democracy, and its relationship to the system that we live in and the system that's destroying the planet. All right, so this does bring us to a close. I'm your host and producer. It's the Michael Slate Show, and I'm the host and producer, Michael Slate, and I want to thank all of my guests today. Henry Giroux, one of the founding theorists of critical pedagogy in the United States, who also serves as the Global TV Network Chair in English and Cultural Studies at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario, and he's also on the board of truthout.org. I also want to thank Lily Hayden, violinist, singer, composer, actress, guitarist. Lily will be joining us again next week for a further, deeper discussion about her work in art. And I also want to thank Dave Lindorf. Dave is a journalist, the founder of the This Can't Be Happening website, and he's a contributor to the upcoming book, Hopeless, Barack Obama and the Politics of Illusion. I also want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, please do. You can write to me at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. We're going to go out now with a song from Gil Scott-Heron. He posed this question in 1980 on the album of the same name, dealing with a question that was posed by the ebb in the revolutionary movement that had developed in the 1960s. And it's a question that is posed very sharply for us today. When push comes to shove, it shows what you're made of. Gil Scott-Heron, Push Comes to Shove. Check it out.
Push comes to shove to find exactly what you're made of. Can't nobody shame you. Can't nobody scold you. Can't nobody blame you and make you feel bad. Nobody should chide you and tell you I told you. Nobody should ride you about commitments you had. Cause they done learned you and they done burned you. Should you idealistic is all you were. Everybody gotta realize that we all had to compromise, had to put on suit and ties. When push came to shove, it seemed like push come to shove once in your lifetime. Yes, and push come to shove to find out just what's on your mind. Push come to shove to find exactly what you made of. Nobody getting on you. Nobody should tease you. Not try to reason you. It made you feel strange. Nobody got to explain. Ain't really nothing to explain. Everything got rearranged in a world of change. But they done taught you, cause they done caught you. Showed you unrealistic is all you were. So everybody once believed was on a show and how naive. You gotta give up to be free.